Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. It is my great pleasure to invite John Lear here today as our guest. He is a retired airline captain and former CIA contract pilot with over 19,000 hours of flight time, over 11,000 in command of 3 or 4 engine jet transports, and he's flown over 100 different types of aircraft in 60 different countries around the world. He retired in 2001 after more than 40 years of commercial flying. He is the son of Learjet inventor Bill Lear, and John holds more FAA airman certificates than any other FAA certificated airman. These include the airline transport pilot certificate with 23 type ratings, flight instructor, flight engineer, flight navigator, ground instructor, aircraft dispatcher, control tower operator, parachute rigger and mechanic, rated for both airframe and power plant. John flew for the CIA in Southeast Asia, where between 1972 and 1973 logged 560 missions, of which over half were combat. He also flew contract missions in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Africa between 1977 and 1982. Over the last 17 years of his career, he's worked for several passenger and cargo airlines as captain, check airman, and instructor, and was certificated by the FAA as the North Atlantic Navigation Check Airman. He has extensive experience as a command pilot and instructor in the Boeing 707, Douglas DC-8, and Lockheed L-1011. He also holds 17 world records, including speed around the world in a Learjet Model 24 set in 1966, and was presented the PATCO, Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association Award for Outstanding Airmanship in 1968. He is a Senior Vice President Commander of the China Post 1, the American Legion's Post for Soldiers of Fortune, and a 29-year member of the Special Operations Association and member, pilot for 911truth.org. John is very controversial and has a lot of things he wants to share with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome John Lear to It's Rainmaking Time.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you. Well, this is so heavy, your pilot background, that I really think we should start there because this has been your life.
Yes, always wanted to be a pilot, and I was a pilot for 40 years. I retired in 2001 and haven't flown since.
What is it like to retire from something that is your life?
Well, I had a lot of things going at the time, and I retired mainly because the company I worked for, Kitty Hawk International, went bankrupt. I was 58 at the time, and you can't get a job as a pilot at 58 because the mandatory retirement age is 60, and nobody wants to train you for just 2 years of service.
Why does a pilot have to retire at 60? Is there an assumption that their skills aren't as good?
I think they've changed it now in the last 1 or 2 years to age 65.
Oh, so then you would have 7 years, right? Or no?
I was 58 in 1998 when the company went bankrupt.
Got it. Okay. How do you harness all this life experience and professional experience as a pilot flying all these different missions all over the world, all these different kinds of planes today? Do you help other pilots at all in any way? Do you consult or mentor other pilots?
No.
Do you have any interest in that?
I am completely out of aviation. I don't even look up in the sky anymore. In 1996, I bought the claims for an operating gold mine up in Gold Butte, Nevada, and I spent the next 10 years rebuilding it and getting it recertificated, but the BLM shut it down just after I started mining, and so then I had to tear it down. Actually, all I had to do was take out my personal stuff, and they're tearing it down now. That happened about 2007.
And you have another mine, right?
I don't own it. I claimed it, and that was the only one. That was the Treasure Hog mine. It's all gone.
Oh, my God, you're out. I notice on your site, The Living Moon, there's a link that says, who owns mineral rights? Just three men. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. There's the three guys. We posted their names, and of course, that's got to be total baloney because there's millions of people that live up on the moon, and we certainly aren't going to claim mineral rights from them.
Let's switch to the moon for a moment. So we talk about mineral rights here on Earth and claiming mineral rights, but there are claims to minerals on the moon. Is that legal?
Apparently it is. There was a United Nations contract or an agreement with all countries that no single country would claim any part of the moon for any reason, but it didn't outlaw specifically a person from claiming it. So these three guys got together and went to the United Nations and claimed those parts of the moon for the mineral rights.
Wow. Does that include something like helium-3, for example? The access to helium-3 that Harrison Schmitt talked about when he was on the moon?
Well, helium-3 can only occur if there's no atmosphere, and the atmosphere on the moon is equivalent to 18,000 feet on the Earth. There isn't a breathable atmosphere up there. If you go to the moon, you have to go through 1 week of decompression, just as if you were climbing Mount Everest. You have to go up 5,000 or 6,000 feet at a time and then spend a week or two acclimating your body to the lower pressure. So when you go to the moon, you have to spend a week acclimating yourself to the low pressure of the moon. But the moon's gravity is 70% of that of Earth, and the atmosphere is about 18,000 feet on Earth.
How do you know this, and how did you get into trying to sort out the atmosphere of the moon? What led you to try to figure that out?
Well, I didn't figure it out. I read Howard Menger's book. He went there in 1956. He was a guest of the people that are on the moon, and he's the one that said that there was a breathable atmosphere. And then I figured out what the gravity was by the Bully-Aldous-Newton law of inverse square, which you don't need to use the density. Now, in order to understand that, you have to understand that Newton's second law is wrong. There is no basis for Newton's assumption that gravitational force is due and is proportional to the quantity or density of matter. So NASA and everybody uses the quantity and density of matter to predict gravity, and it's not true. That's not the way it works. So they used an assumption of the moon being 3.34 grams per cubic centimeter as the density of the moon and 5.5 grams per centimeter cubed for the density of the Earth. And through that, they worked out the density of the moon would be 1/6 that of Earth, but that's not true. There is no basis that gravitational force is due to the quantity or density of matter. There's a good book on that called Gravitational Force of the Sun by Perry Spalter. It's S-P-O-L-T-E-R. And she explains the whole thing mathematically and scientifically. And for anybody who's interested in, I suggest you get that book and catch up on the new science.
How come NASA's not integrating the new science that you're describing in the way that they are operating?
Because they are hiding everything that they know about our solar system and the universe. Our solar system has a tremendous population on every single planet, on every single moon, and every single satellite in our solar system. In other words, there's people on Venus, on the moon, on Mars, on Jupiter, on Neptune, on Saturn, on Pluto, and all the rest. Not only on the planets, but on the planets, moons, and satellites. The solar system is teeming with people just like us, humans just like us, and also alien forms of all different kinds.
You say that with such calmness and poise.
Well, it's true.
How do you explain to the public who doesn't have a frame of reference for the fact that there's a secret space program? Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. Google the United States Space Command and see how many divisions there are under the Space Command. We have about 4,000 astronauts, current and qualified, that go to all the space stations we have around the Earth. We have 26 orbiting offensive weaponized satellites, and the Navy has 2 command satellites that they use to operate these weaponized orbiting satellites. That's in addition to the ISS, the International Space Station. There's no reason anybody should know this. They wouldn't comprehend it. It's not part of their day. Most people's day is made up of going to work, trying to make a living, trying to feed their family, and there's no need for them to worry about or know about what's going on.
Why does it help to know?
It doesn't help to know. Knowledge is power. It's fun to know all the really secret stuff that's going on, but there's nothing you can do about it.
In your site, The Living Moon, at thelivingmoon.com, you're saying that it's populated, there's activity. And what else are you saying?
Well, it's almost just like Earth. It's a little bit more barren, but there certainly are lakes and rivers, cities, factories, forests and meadows and everything else, both on the near side and the far side. Most of it on the near side is hidden by holographic technology, which means that they can overlay a barren desert or a barren mare or sea over a city, so that when you look at it through a telescope, it looks like there's something there. But actually, it's just being hidden by holographic technology.
And talk about holographic technology, because this seems to play into a lot of different things that have been going on in the world. Explain it to us. What is it?
Holographic technology is the technology of projecting a object moving with light, heat, and noise, if you want, or projecting any kind of an image you want over any kind of an area. For instance, the new Area 51, which is south of Wendover, Utah, just inside Nevada, is hidden by holographic technology. You could fly over it, and all you'll see is a forest. But under it is a new secret base. It's the new secret Area 51. And when I say new, it's about 20 years old. It's been there for a long, long time. Holographic technology is like this. For instance, I was told by a movie producer who went to a conference, a special showing, and the title was The Future of TV. There was about 30 people there, and it was in a very well-lit, small auditorium. There was a stage at the podium, and there was about 30 people there, all high industry figures in the movie business. And a gentleman came out from behind the curtains. A European gentleman with glasses, white hair, stepped up to the podium and started to talk about the history of television. And he started with the cathode ray tube, how that was first developed. He talked about kinescope recordings and how they developed into film recordings and how it developed into what we have today. And as he's talking, he stepped off the podium. He walked up one aisle, took off his glasses, cleaned his glasses, walked down that aisle, walked up another aisle, cleaned his glasses again, walked back down, and then he stepped up again to the podium. And as he finished, he said, "Thank you for your attention." And then he went out like you switch off a light bulb. And the point of all this was to show how holographic technology, at what point it was now. In other words, if they were able to project a person giving a lecture, there was no real person there. So what that means is future TV, within the next 5-10 years, all you'll have is a little remote control, like you have a remote control for your TV, and you'll turn it on, and you can project the show that you're looking at in the middle of the room, or you can put it on the table or anywhere else you want, and you can increase the size, decrease the size, and you can walk around 360 degrees of what's going on. You can actually touch the figures. Actually, there'll be nothing there, but you can actually touch them. And that was the future of television. That's how holographic works. Now, the same thing worked in 9/11. The projection of the airplane was a holographic projection. There were no airplanes. No airplanes crashed at the World Trade Center. No airplane crashed at Shanksville. No airplane crashed at the Pentagon. All three separate accidents, the World Trade Center, were holograms. The Pentagon was a flyover where the airplane just flew over and they set off an explosion and the airplane flew off to another secret underground base. And as far as Shanksville, the reason Shanksville happened is because somehow the holographic projector either failed or they were unable to project an airplane crashing into building number 7. So after about 6 hours of deciding what to do, they knew they had to fake it. So what they did is they faked an airplane crash at Shanksville, using that time to get people in white suits in the fire department and scattering around a few parts, and then releasing the news to the public, and then collapsing the building. And then nobody asked any questions about why it collapsed. I mean, it's totally ridiculous that it could have been demolition because there was hardly anything left. Same thing with the World Trade Center. If you use controlled demolition to destroy a building, you're going to have 13% of the debris left. So that means if you had a 100-story building that you were collapsing, you would have 13 stories left of debris, concrete, steel, desks, file cabinets, all that stuff. But in the case of the World Trade Center, there was nothing left. There was one story left. There was no desk, no file cabinets, no toilets, no bodies, no nothing, no airplanes, no nothing. there was just nothing there. And the way they did that is using one of these really high-tech weapons using molecular disassociation. And what they do is when they fire it, it destroys matter into its molecular components. That's why there was so much dust left around the Manhattan area, about 3 inches of dust. All of the dust was about 80 microns in diameter. That's what molecular disassociation does. It just disintegrates everything into dust.
You know, there are some people, and I want to qualify this carefully, there are some people that would say that A, to question the event is treasonous, B, to talk about it, questioning it is treasonous, and then to provide an alternative take or method of discovery is treasonous. But I have to tell you that when I saw, what was it, Building 3? What was the building that just collapsed in its own footprint?
Building 7.
Building 7. When I saw the state of the Pentagon and there was no airplane, and the Shanksville thing, the hole in the ground, there was no airplane, nothing. I knew something was amiss, but so many people have had in their mind these imprints of what we were shown on television. How is that possible to coordinate all that?
It was a careful coordination of the people who perpetrated this thing using essentially magic that people don't know anything about, and then they bought it. Shanksville, I don't know how anybody who knew anything about airplane or airplane crashes could believe that the one little turbine that was in the bucket of the bulldozer was all that was left of a Boeing 757, which crashed upside down at a 30-degree angle at Shanksville. It just cannot happen. There's just too much debris there. There would have been debris all over the place. And the official story was that it dove into the ground, and the ground was so soft from a previous mining operation that it just disappeared, but that's impossible. There was no airplane.
Shanksville really showed us that they think we're stupid.
Right. There's a lot of people that still believe that. Now, there's a lot of people that say, hey, what's going on here? But, you know, a lot of people just went on with their lives, and they go through all this baloney of going through checkpoints at the airports and being stripped down and probed and searched and everything for things to blow up an airplane when, in fact, that hijacking never happened. It's impossible. There is no such thing as an Arab with time in a 172 that could have flown an airplane like a Boeing 767 and hit a building dead center at 500 miles an hour.
Talk about why. And when I saw you writing about that, I really felt like you should speak about it, the impossibility of it from a pilot's point of view.
Well, first of all, you would have to incapacitate the crew. So that means that if one hijacker went into the cockpit, the only way he's going to incapacitate the crew would be to slit their throats. And the way he'd have to do that is with a knife, and he'd have to cut the carotid artery. Blood would start spraying all over the cockpit. At the same time, he's going to have to slit the throat of the other guy in the cockpit and get his carotid artery, too, in order to incapacitate them. If he didn't, they're going to fight them to the death. So, first of all, that's ridiculous that the hijacker could do that. But assuming he did, that means that he'd have to lift the body of the pilot.
And co-pilot, right?
Well, no, just the pilot,
okay,
out of the seat, because he has to sit there. So that means he has to figure out how to pull that seat back in a Boeing 67. Now, there's two ways, manually and electrically. And for an Arab who has no knowledge of a 767, it's not possible to believe that he could figure out how to pull that seat back in order to get him out. Because when you pull the seat forward to fly an airplane, your feet stick way forward to the rudder pedals. But let's assume that he did that. Now, remember, there's blood all over the place. There's blood all over the wheel. You fly the airplane, there's blood all over the instruments. There's blood all over the seat. And now he's got to figure out how to disconnect the seatbelt that the pilot wears. It's a 5-connection seatbelt. So he's got to figure out how to get that off. Now he's got to lift the bloody body out of the seat and put him in the companionway and then sit in there and start to fly the airplane. Now, remember, there's going to be blood all over the place, and he's got to put his hands on this sticky mess and try and figure out how to fly this airplane. Now, all these Boeing 67s, they're all new instrument displays, which he could have never possibly figured out to make a 180-degree turn and head back to New York 90 miles and find New York. It's not like he can just look around the horizon and find New York. You can't see it from 90 miles. So he has to figure out how to navigate to get there, and then he has to figure out how to make the turn and make the descent into the building. Now, the speeds that everybody says, and when I say everybody, the government and NASA and everybody, is 560 miles an hour. That's impossible for a Boeing 767. Its maximum speed is 360 knots. If you go any faster than that, parts are going to start coming off, and it's going to be unable to fly. Now, the Boeing 67 in flight test has flown up to 420 knots, but that's under very, very special conditions, and a hijacker would not be able to fly it under those very special conditions. And he certainly wouldn't be able to fly at 50 knots faster, which would be 470 knots. That's about 560 miles an hour. That's impossible. It cannot happen aerodynamically, and it cannot happen in real life. So all that speed stuff was fake. But to be able to hit a building at 800 feet altitude and hit a dead center is equally impossible.
Why?
All this done was with holographic projections, and there was probably a few controlled demolitions in the basement, but most of the damage was done by the weaponized satellites that the Navy controls.
How come you can talk about it without fear?
Because I don't reach that big an audience. It's not like I was on Larry King or anything like that. They don't bother me if I talk about it with, say, an audience of 50 or 60 or 100. That doesn't bother them. It's not a threat.
Is it not a threat because, for the most part, the average person wouldn't allow it in their consciousness for contemplation?
Right. They just couldn't believe it.
Talk to us about why hitting the building dead center is just ridiculous.
Well, it's only 208 feet wide. And even the most proficient pilot at the top of my proficiency, at the end of my career, as good as I was, I couldn't have hit it. I mean, you're just going too fast to be able to hit something 208 feet wide dead center. You just can't do it. You're going too fast.
What if it was only going 300 miles per hour?
You might get a little closer. Sure.
What if they say, well, the radar got it wrong. It wasn't 575 miles per hour. It was only 300.
300 miles an hour, you might be able to do it. Yeah, you might be able to do it. But, you know, hitting a dead center, the fact is no part of any kind was ever found in or near either of the buildings. There was an engine that came off a 747. It was actually the turbine part of the engine, and that was found on Murray Street. But that was not an engine that came off United 175, which was the one that crashed into the South Tower. Each airplane, a Boeing 767, has about 3 million parts, and all of these parts are labeled. They all have to have a PMA, which is a parts manufacturer authority number on it, either stamped or written or embossed in some way. None of those parts were found or identified. And then you have two massive engines that normally take temperatures of 800 degrees centigrade or hotter, and they just cannot disappear. It's not possible. All we had was a fuel fire. JP4 doesn't burn that hot. And it was out in about 2 or 3 minutes, so there was nothing to propagate or make the fire intensify. It had to be done someplace else, and there was no parts identified, and people say, well, maybe they cleaned it all up. Okay, well, you know, if I was doing this cover-up, I would have certainly been delighted to load an engine on a truck from all the debris and say, here it is, here's the engine of the airplane, we got it, you know, but they didn't. All there was just a little bit of steel, and that was hauled out in about 3 or 4 days.
How come people say they saw airplanes? Are you saying that is the holographic projection?
That is the hologram. And there's 31 videos, and all of those videos are holograms.
Amazing. Which tells us then that this technology is so advanced that it's probably used for warfare, right?
Yes, it was developed and operational about 20 years ago. It is used for warfare all the time. It's standard in the military operation. They use it all the time. Also, they use the weaponized satellites all the time, but you're not going to hear about it.
What are you doing with Truth for 9/11 Pilots? What is happening with that organization?
I'm just a core member, which means one of the first members of Pilots for Truth on 9/11, and they do a lot of excellent work on the Pentagon, and I just support what they're doing.
You're all very brave to be talking about it.
They have some videos that are just outstanding, which prove some of the things I'm talking about. In Flight 77, I was the one that discovered that when they started to descend, that it was the only flight recorder data released by the FBI and the National Transportation Safety Board. One of the interesting things that I found is I know how to read digital flight recorder outputs. There's 156 parameters that they read, and they read it 8 times a second. And it comes in a roll, and you can put it on your computer and start reading all this. Well, one of the things I went for first was to look at some of the things that happened when they descended. Now, when they descended at 18,000 feet, that's when you go from standard barometric pressure of 2992 inches of mercury to the local barometric setting. And it appears that from the digital flight recorder that the co-pilot set his first, and then the pilot set his about 30 seconds later to the local barometric pressure. Now, there's two things wrong with that. Number one, there was no co-pilot. Hani Honjura was the only pilot flying. And why would he undo his seatbelt and reach way over to the co-pilot altimeter and reset it, and then reset his? And then the second question is, how in the heck did he know what the barometric pressure of Ronald Reagan International Airport was in the first place? He wasn't talking to anybody. There's no recordings of him calling air traffic control and asking for the barometric pressure. And why would he need the barometric pressure anyway? He was going to crash. He doesn't need to know the exact altitude he is off the ground. Setting the local barometric pressure is for instrument approaches, when you have to know exactly how many feet you are above the ground. So that was the first mistake they made. Then the next mistake they made was they didn't know that there's a third hidden altimeter off which the digital flight recorder records its altitude information. And it's set to 2992. For the people that were trying to fake all this, use that altitude for hitting the Pentagon. Well, the problem is the actual barometric pressure at Ronald Reagan International was 30.11 or 30.21, and if you extrapolate that, you'll find that the airplane actually overflew the Pentagon by 300 feet. But the people that pulled this off didn't know that little tiny detail. They were taking the readings off the pilot's altimeter. So that proves that the airplane overflew. We have April Gallup, who was an Army intelligence officer, who was sitting 40 feet away. Her desk was 40 feet away from the hole, and she said there was an explosion. She saw no airplane, no drone, no nothing of any kind, smelled no fuel, no gas, no jet fuel, no JP-7, no JP-4, no nothing. And she picked up her six-month-old son, who was sitting in a baby carrier below her seat, and she climbed out that hole, and she went over onto the grass for triage treatment, where they treat you for injuries.
Okay.
And she won't change her story, and the Army has harassed her for the last 8 or 10 years.
And what is she doing now?
I don't know. I haven't kept up with it.
Wow, this is really heavy. It's really, really heavy. What happens to all these pilots who come forth to talk about it the way you talk about it? Are they still flying? Have they been dismissed? Are they retired?
Nobody usually talks about it. There's a lot of pilots that joined Pilots for Truth, but they don't do a lot of talking about it because they're dependent on their jobs. Pretty much everybody knows that the truth would probably never come out. And although there are people that are really trying to get the truth out, it's very difficult to happen. I was part of the suit against the 23 companies that participated in this, all located in New Mexico and New York. And it was called a quidam complaint filed by Morgan Reynolds. It was suing those 23 companies for their participation in 9/11. And I wrote an affidavit and submitted it to the New York District Court to prove, it was a 15-page affidavit, which proves scientifically and mathematically that an airplane could not go that fast, and to prove that there was no airplanes in the first place. But it was dismissed in July of 2009, I think it was. It was just summarily dismissed. They didn't read it at all. It was just dismissed from the court. So, you know, they have the secret government, or whoever runs this has control of everybody. They have control of the courts, the government, and the whole thing.
I don't even know where to go from there.
Well, let me tell you, people will say now, so what do we do? And I say the only thing you can do, and the only thing you should do, is worry about yourself. Don't worry about the other guy. Don't worry about 9/11. Don't worry about the starving people in Africa. Don't worry about the killings in Afghanistan and Iraq. Just worry about yourself and living your life with, number one, integrity, and without envy, hate, or greed. That's all you have to do. Because until you learn how to live your life with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed, you're going to keep reincarnating on Earth. Because that's the lesson you have to learn. Now, when you have learned that, you get to go out into the solar system and play with the real adults. There's fantastic places to go. I mean, there's 100 billion universes just like ours. There's 1 billion Earths just like ours, some more advanced, some less advanced. But you're not going to get to go out there and play with them, play with the adults, until you learn how to live your life with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed.
That's a very advanced message.
So the people that say, well, what do we do? What do we do? Who do we elect to do something? Well, first of all, the President of the United States has nothing to do with anything. The day he steps into office, a couple of gentlemen come into the office, and they tell him exactly what he's going to do, no matter what campaign promises he made. Because a president of the United States is a figurehead. He has nothing to do with anything. He doesn't have a clearance high enough to know what's going on anyway. Clearances work like this. The lowest clearance you can get is top secret. Above that, there's 38 levels of clearances. It goes top secret crypto 1 through 28. And then above that, there's 10 clearances. Each have a name, like Umbra and Ultra, the top being Majestic. Well, the President of the United States only has a clearance of maybe top secret crypto 17. He has no need to know all this. And besides, he's only in there for a short time, and there's no way to vet him. And the intelligence services have traditionally hated elected or appointed officials, so they don't give him any clearance and they don't tell him anything. So there's nothing they can do because they don't know what's going on.
Are you referring to, for example, NSA is the one who walks in and talks to the president and lay it out?
NSA is probably part of it, but it's not NSA, no. It's somebody else much higher than NSA. But NSA is certainly in the know on this.
It's really wild, isn't it? And so when people are fighting for democracy, they don't really understand, not that they don't make a difference, but that there's this other universe of things going on. There's this parallel system of activity that is countering what we would call true democracy, or the democratization of a society.
Well, people think we're a democracy. In fact, we're a, it's escaped me now, but democracies usually only last 100 years anyway. Democracy means one person, one vote. And that's not the way it works. When we vote for a president, we're not actually voting for the president. It's not the numbers. We vote for electoral representatives.
Your work with and about the moon is pivotal to demonstrating something that's essential to you. What is it that you say when you have met with or talked to other astronauts about what's going on there? We don't need to know the names of those people unless you want to mention them, but how are they able to deal with what they actually saw versus what they have to come home to communicate?
Well, first of all, no astronaut went to the moon. Apollo was a complete fake. It was all done in a studio. There's many videos out on, if you go to thelivingmoon.com, you'll see how they did it and where they did it and how they faked it. But there's no possibility they could have gone to the moon simply because the Van Allen belt is so full of radiation. It extends from about 450 miles above the Earth to 25,000 miles. And that's mainly to keep us here. This is a nursery where we are expected to mature our soul. And by maturing, I mean living with integrity and without envy, hate, and fear. And we're not allowed to go out and spread our warlike efforts to any place else. So we're kept in this nursery. Now, there are a few that are let out from time to time. The moon people come down and they take a few scientists out to the moon to show them what's going on. But that's never told publicly. But the Apollo missions were just a fake. And the money that was supposed to go to Apollo were used to put these 24 or 26 weaponized satellites up there.
Are you telling me Harrison Schmitt never went to the moon?
No possibility.
I don't get it. Explain it again. I understood the part that you said about the radiation belt. But are you saying that because the radiation is so strong, we couldn't get there?
No. We only had a thin shielding of aluminum on the lunar spacecraft that went there. There's no possibility we could have gotten there. But even if we did go there, the moon has a gravity of 70% of Earth. They only had 22,000 pounds of fuel in the lunar lander. And with 22,000 pounds of fuel, They're telling us they deorbited at 60 miles, landed, then took off, reorbited, redocked with the command module, and flew back to Earth. It's impossible with 70% the gravity of Earth. And besides, none of us ever saw any movies of the lunar lander successfully flying. It didn't fly. It couldn't fly. It was a disaster. But anyway, yeah, they did fake the whole thing. Nobody went to the moon. And that's why the astronauts don't talk a lot. It's an interesting fact that there has never, ever been a reunion of all the moon astronauts, simply because they don't want to talk about it. They were involved in a fake, and I don't know what they told them or how to get them involved in staying there, but they did. Now, one of the ways they did it is when they murdered Gus Grissom on January 27th. 1967. Gus Grissom was very, very outspoken in the development of the Apollo program. And he was saying, this thing is nuts. He said, quote, this thing ain't going to the moon in 2 years. This thing ain't going to the moon in 10 years. So on January 27th, they sparked a fire inside the cabin and killed the four astronauts that were inside there. That was Gus Grissom, White and Chaffee, and then there was a secret astronaut who was part of the secret team in there helping them sort out the problems that they were having with Apollo 1, and he was lying down there facing the different direction as the astronauts. His head was on the console, and his feet stuck down into the area where the moon rocks were to be kept. But those four were killed on January 27, 1967, and the message was to anybody else who wanted to say something about this program, they better keep their mouth shut or the same thing was going to happen to them.
So all of these astronauts who are coming forward, training, grew up wanting to be an astronaut, preparing the shuttles, when they fly in front of us and they take off, we're all watching it on TV and people are at Cape Canaveral, where do they go?
The shuttle goes up to the International Space Station.
Do they know this ahead of time? That they're not going to be doing what they think they're going to be doing.
That was the Apollo program. That was 30 years ago.
Okay.
The shuttle program started in around the early 80s, and it was always designed to go to the International Space Station. There's no question that it goes there.
How do you get your photos from the moon?
I got them from early NASA books. I walked into Powell's bookstore in Portland, Oregon, many years ago, and I bought every single issue of NASA's books just on speculation, and I don't know why I bought them. I just bought them, and it turned out that 20 years later, they were immensely valuable because all NASA books printed prior to 1970 have very poorly airbrushed photos of the moon. They weren't very serious about it, and they were just using airbrush and paint brushes to paint the stuff out. But they never dreamed in the early 70s that in the 90s we would have personal computers that could enlarge that stuff and look beneath the airbrushing. And they missed a lot of things because they never thought we'd be able to enlarge them to the way we can these days. And that's where I get all my photos of the spaceports, the buildings, and all the stuff that I post on the Living Moon.
I saw an interview with you online where you described the moon as a satellite. What does that mean?
The moon was made in the bowels of Jupiter. And it was towed here about 15,000 years ago, and they are our keepers. Humans live up there, and the grays live underground up there. And their job is to watch our development, keeping us from getting into too much trouble, and kind of just overseeing the nursery. And they watch us every day, every night, 24/7. If you were able to turn a switch and see all that was going on, which is impossible, you would be just amazed. The sky would be just filled with flying saucers. They pick up every human being once at 3 years old, once at 7 years old, and once at 13 years old, and they do just a normal check to see that everything is okay. And then after 13, they pick you up on an as-needed basis if you need some kind of update or correction or something like that in your quest to mature your soul.
How does this sit with the human being's connection to a creator? I'm just curious your perspective on that. How does this fly in the face of our connection to a creator?
Well, the aliens created us. Our bodies are just meat sacks. They're places that our soul lives in. Our soul has to develop and to learn to live with integrity and without envy, hate, or fear. And this is just a suit we're given for our bodies. They're called containers. We live a life, and after we die, we're immediately reunited with all our friends who have passed away for about a few minutes. And then we're taken someplace, and we're shown every single little nasty thing we ever did in our life, and every good thing, and there is no judgment of whether it's good or bad. And then we're put back into a newborn baby about 3 days old, and then we do it all over again. And we keep reincarnating like that until we have learned to live with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed.
Very interesting. John Leonard Walson, on your site, you say is the biggest discovery ever.
Right. He was the first one to catch the pictures of those weaponized satellites that we have been putting up for the last 40 years, and he happened to catch pictures of them, and they're fascinating because the pictures he has are fascinating pictures of technology that is far beyond anything that the American public knows about.
Let's go back for just a moment about when you said that the moon was towed in. Where did you get that information? How did you get it?
The information, if you'll go back in history, in the early memories of man, there are several writers. You can look at Velikovsky, and he wrote a lot about this. In the earliest memories of man, there was a time when there was no moon, and then there was two moons, and then there was the moon that we have today. That moon was towed here about 15,000 years ago in order to be a keeper. Now, the information about it being made in the bowels of Jupiter comes from Sleeper Lou Balden from his website. And he's been around a long time, so he knows a lot of stuff. Now, the actual towing vehicle was called the EMV, electromagnetic vehicle. And a retired Lockheed engineer wrote a book called The Ringmakers of Saturn. He wrote how this EMV works because he took some of the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 photos, original from NASA, and he found in the rings of Saturn some very large spaceships, the largest of which was 30,000 miles long and 2,400 miles in diameter. He puts these pictures in his book, The Ringmakers of Saturn. But at the end of the book, he talks about where the EMV grabbed on to the moon to tow it, and that was Mare Orientale. You can see the rings around it where some electromagnetic vehicle grabbed onto it. And then I was talking with Norman one day, and I said, well, where do you think that EMV vehicle is now? And he says, I think it's on the backside of the moon. And so I looked at the pictures of the backside of the moon that I had, and I found it in the crater Tchaikovsky. And it's very interesting that NASA has gone to utmost lengths to keep the pictures of Tchaikovsky a secret. They make the vehicle look like a piece of land. But if you'll go on thelivingmoon.com, you'll see that we found, just purely by good research and by accident, a picture of the electromagnetic vehicle sitting right in the middle of the Sea of Tchaikovsky, or the Mare Tchaikovsky. How we got it was a friend of ours in Florida was researching some NASA pictures, and she was looking at thumbnail pictures that were available. And what they did is, on one of these thumbnails, they thought they'd just print the real picture because it was too small to see anyway. But with the techniques that we have today of enlargement, we can enlarge it all the way up and see what's really there. What they didn't bother to do, or what they forgot to do, was enlarge that picture, change it to what they wanted it to look like, and then reduce it back down to a thumbnail. They just printed it as a thumbnail, and that's how we got the real picture of the electromagnetic vehicle that towed the moon from Jupiter and placed it in orbit around the Earth.
The whole relationship to the moon has lost its romantic quality for me. The moon has been so romantic for all of us. Now it's a satellite. It's really, it's mind-boggling. What do you think Richard Branson founder of Virgin Galactic, who is going to be sending people for suborbital flights around the Earth. What do you think he knows regarding the true scenario?
Nothing. He doesn't know anything.
How is all this money amassed?
Where does the money come from?
Yeah.
Drugs. We control all the drugs distributed in the world. And one of the reasons we pulled off the 9/11 was we wanted control of the drug industry in Afghanistan. Now, most of the illegal opium and marijuana drugs are grown in the Hindu Kush, which is in northern Afghanistan. And their output in 2001 was 15% of the world's supply. In 2007, according to the New York Times, it was 95% of the world's supply. Now, the Taliban didn't do that, and neither did Al-Qaeda. They just don't have the resources. It was us that did it. We went in there, into Afghanistan, under the pretense of fighting a war against the Al-Qaeda and Taliban in order to get control of the Hindu Kush. And there's hundreds of thousands of acres where marijuana and opium are grown and shipped north to Kazakhstan and then shipped and distributed by various secret groups around the world. And that's a tremendous income. That's trillions of dollars that we use for programs that we want to do that we don't want to tell the president or Congress about. If there's one thing the intelligence or the secret government hates to do, it hates to go to Congress and ask for money, because Congress always wants to know, well, what are you going to do with it? And they don't want to tell them what they're going to do with it. So the best thing is to control the world drug market and distribution and use all that money for whatever they want. It's a cash crop. It's cash money that they can do whatever they want with.
Some people may feel and think that because you have flown missions for the CIA, that how do we accept you? How do we receive you? How do we believe you? What are we to think about you?
You don't have to believe me. I flew for the CIA. I was a pilot, and they don't tell pilots anything. I was not an agent. I was not an operative. I didn't have a file. I was a contract pilot. They'd call me up and say, go from here to there, and I'd go from here to there. They would tell me nothing about what I was taking or what was in the back or why I was doing it. I just did it.
Got it. Let's talk a little bit about the NASA scientist that was fired who promised disclosure.
Who was that?
Is it Hoagland?
Well, Richard Hoagland, I don't know whether he was fired or not. I never heard that story. But
okay, I'm sorry. Excuse me. It was Ken Johnson, was it?
Oh, Ken Johnson.
Yes, let's talk about Ken Johnson.
Yeah, I don't know too much about him. I read Hoagland's book called Dark Moon or Dark Missions or
something. Right.
Yeah. And it's a very good book, but, you know, Hoagland believes that what we're seeing on the moon is an ancient society. It's not. It's living and thriving today. He talks about these glass domes that you can see in the Apollo pictures, but the Apollo program was a fake. You're seeing pictures that were taken on a set. Most of the stuff he talks about is wrong, even though I credit him for getting me interested in this with his videotape, Moon Mars Connection Number 2, which showed me the gigantic 6-mile-high tower in the middle of the near side that we can see near Sinus Medi. And it's a huge, huge structure supported by a tripod. And on top of it, there's a square or a cube that's 1 mile on each side. And it's transparent. It's like it's made out of glass. When I first saw the pictures of that, boy, I thought that was really neat. About the same time, I was reading a book by Joe McMonagle.
The Remote Viewer?
Yeah, and he talked about following a soul. He was tasked to follow a soul after a man died in a car collision between Monterey and San Francisco, and he followed it towards the moon. And he's got closer and closer. A voice started telling him, do not come any closer. This is not your place. You're not allowed here. And he followed it until the noise got so loud and so threatening that he broke off the chase and didn't go any further. But then that kind of clued me in. If the soul was going to the moon, where was it going? And I thought, well, it might be going to that great big tower. Maybe that's a transfer tower where they transfer souls. There are various schools of thought on that. There's transfer stations on Earth, but when you die, your soul goes into a transfer station. You're allowed to see your past loved ones, and then you get a review of your life, and then you're reincarnated into a baby about 3 days old, and you start it all over again. And there's several, and I don't know how many, there's several of those transfer for stations around Earth. I thought that that big cube might have been a transfer station, but I found some opposition to that by people who are very knowledgeable. So I don't know what the story is. I still maintain that since McMonagall followed the soul there, that that probably is a transfer station.
I just did a piece with Lynn Buchanan, who teaches controlled remote viewing, who also was in the program years ago for the Navy intelligence and as a professional remote viewer for 8 years. It's very, very interesting how you can find out from the past, you can go into the future, and how our whole notion of time is completely upside down. It doesn't even exist.
Right.
And it changes life, doesn't it? It changes your whole life when you get that.
Yeah.
What are your wishes for the coming years of your life?
I'm hoping to live the remainder of my life with integrity and without envy, hate, or greed. I just know what's going on, and I'm happy to sit here and talk with people and tell them what I know and play with my computer. I can't walk very well anymore. I had a serious airplane accident in 1961. And as I get older, I can't walk very well anymore. So I use a walker. So I don't go anywhere. And I refuse to go anywhere on airplanes because I will not be subjected to a cavity search when I flew as an airline captain for 40 years. It's just demeaning. I won't do it. I don't drive very far. I'm most likely a homebody. I try and keep my lawn green in the front of the yard, and we're kind of fixing up the backyard now. And I spend a lot of time with my 9-year-old grandson, who is just the greatest guy in the world. He's so smart and just so interested in everything I have to say. And I teach him geography, and I teach him navigation, and I taught him how to ride his motorcycle and just everything. We have a great time together and a great relationship.
That's awesome. How has it been like between you and your wife? And I don't mean to be too personal, but basically with all of the research that you've done and all that you've spoken about, does she hear what you speak about? Do you talk about these things together ever? Or is it considered like that's your calling, that's your work, that's over on the left and your relationship is on the right? Or is there a connect at all?
No, we don't discuss it at all.
Wow. That's maybe that's best. It keeps you balanced, right?
If she doesn't want to discuss it, she doesn't believe it, and that's fine with me. We have two completely different lives. I live in one side of the house with my den. When film crews come, they come to this side, and she has her own office in the living room where she's a casting director. She was a movie starlet in the 60s, did a lot of the Elvis movies, did the Beverly Hillbillies.
Wow.
A lot of those. And then when we got married, we had two children, Allie and Jackie, and she spent a lot of time working with them. I have four grandchildren, two granddaughters and two grandsons.
That's awesome. Have you ever met or wanted to meet what we would refer to as an alien being?
No, I probably have, but I wouldn't remember it. They erase your
Bless
memory
you.
From any contact you've ever had. And most people have a lot of contact, but they make it so that you don't remember it because it's so frightening.
Let's talk a little bit about the underground bases. Many of us have heard of it. Some of us have read books about it. Others of us don't believe it, that there's cities and mag trains and all kinds of activity going on below the ground. Lay out the context for us. What are we supposed to know?
So we're supposed to know that there's nothing underground, but there's actually 200,000 miles of highway underground. There's large cities underground that we made. Further underground are alien civilizations. I don't know how many. There's more than one. There may be four or five different civilizations, but that's deep underground. And one of the axes is the North Pole to get down in there. But just civilian stuff, like secret military stuff, there's so many underground bases. They go a mile deep. They're all around the place. I mean, they have these tunnel boring machines that work at super high speed, and also they use clean atomic weapons to build these huge places. What they do there, I don't know. What they store there, I don't know. What their purpose is, I don't know.
Have you ever been threatened by anybody?
Never.
You seem to have a lot of protection around you.
A very good friend of mine has some tremendous photos of artifacts on the moon, and he got together with Jose, I think his name is Escamilla, who who has also tremendous photos of the moon, and they were going to make a TV production. And this friend of mine was called by someone who threatened him. Now he won't even talk about it. His website is down, and he was doing the same stuff I was doing. The only difference was he was working with Apollo Pictures, and I was working with Lunar Orbiter Pictures. So I don't know who called him. He won't talk about it. As good as friends as he and I were, he won't discuss the phone call with me. He just said, I got a phone call, and that's all I'm saying.
Got it. Fear is powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
There will be some people listening for whom this conversation is so way out that they won't be able to internalize it.
That's okay. They're not supposed to. If they're not ready, they won't get it. And not everybody is ready. As a matter of fact, 99% of the people are not ready. So people say, I just can't believe this. I said, that's okay. You're not ready. And when you're ready, you will understand it and you will see all the stuff that I do. But in your state of development, you're not ready to absorb or accept this information. So don't worry about it.
Are you for disclosure, or are you not sure if disclosure should happen on a worldwide basis?
I'm not for or against it. I'm just saying it's not going to happen for 6 to 8 decades. It's just not going to happen. It's a pipe dream. The people that are behind disclosure think that they're going to actually do something, but they're not. The aliens don't want disclosure. The U.S. doesn't want disclosure, and it's just not going to happen.
It is interesting, though, that all kinds of people are stepping forward, though, to articulate what they've seen, what they've been present to, from pilots to people on the ground, people that are serving in the military. I think that that part is good, even if the civilization's not ready yet.
Yeah, that's fine, but nobody's going to listen to it that isn't ready, and that includes 99% of the population of the world.
Do you think, John, that's because of the place of religion in most people's lives?
Yeah, the aliens invented religion to give us a set of rules to live by so we wouldn't hurt ourselves while we're maturing our souls. Of course, it hasn't done them much good because there are more people killed in religious wars than actual wars.
Quite amazing. What do you think alien beings want with us? What do they want with us? They're obviously here. They've been here forever. What do they want with this civilization? What are we to grow into? Matured souls that are integrated in love and togetherness and peace?
Well, first of all, there's a billion types of aliens, billions of them. And all of them have different agendas. The ones that are directly responsible for us are the grays. And they're responsible for seeing that we are operating normally. Everything is written. This whole scenario, this whole life that we're living is already written. They know exactly when we're going to die, and they handle those things. If we get in a fatal car accident and it's not our time to die, then they see that we live. And then they see that we die at the exact moment that we're supposed to die. It's all written down.
So when the Bible says it is written, it truly is written.
Right.
There is something to that.
Right.
Do you think that there will be some type of advanced war in your and my lifetime?
Between who and who?
I don't know. Some type of nuclear or other type of dimensional war that causes massive casualties and a restructuring of life on Earth.
No, there's not going to be anything like that. There'll be your normal type wars like between the U.S. and Iraq and U.S. and Iran and Israel and Iran, and they may use nuclear bombs, but there's going to be no massive thing. All this stuff you hear about Planet X and Planet Nibiru and the end of times in 2012, that's all BS. None of that is going to happen.
I asked Lynn Buchanan about that in his remote viewing work, and he said, think of 2012 like Y2K and you'll be fine.
Yeah, he's exactly right.
If in fact it is so that alien civilizations are really running the show, I can't imagine that they would want the entire Earth ruined. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No, of course not.
I remember I did an interview years ago with Carol Rosen for television in Los Angeles. And she was talking about how missile silos have been thwarted, just stopped, so that the missiles couldn't go off and bombs couldn't go off. And she was referring to off-planet life having something to do with that. I thought that was fascinating. But at the time that happened, that interview in 2003, it was interesting to contemplate, but I didn't really take it in as being factual. I didn't take it in as being not factual, but I didn't really take in how deadly serious she was on that point.
Yeah.
And I remember us talking about her interest in preventing the weaponization of space. And basically what I'm learning from you today is that it's already done.
Right.
And it's been done for how long, John?
Forever. See, there was no Big Bang. There was no beginning of the universe. It's been going on forever, and it will go on forever. There's no limit to what's out there. There's hundreds of billions of universes, and it goes on forever.
So everything the scientists and the physicists and the astronomers are learning is like baby cakes. It's full of mistruths.
Right.
Let's talk about Stephen Hawking and what he's now saying about get ready and concern yourself with devilish, dangerous alien life. What do you think about it?
It's BS. There are some aliens that are hostile, but the ones that are taking care of us will take care of the hostile ones. But as far as all aliens being hostile, that's just part of the big scenario that we have to prepare for an alien invasion. And it's all nonsense. It's not going to happen.
Because he just came out with that a few months ago. Do you remember?
Yeah, he's probably given a top secret briefing, and since he's very well known, he was probably told, yeah, it's going to happen, and we need you to say this and need you to say that, and so he did, but it's all nonsense. It's not going to happen. Nothing to worry about.
I can't believe the level of peace in your voice. You have such peace and tranquility, like composure and at one with whatever.
A lot of people say that. I don't know. It's just the way I normally talk.
The Rings of Saturn. There's a book.
Right. Written by Norman Berggren, a good friend of mine, lives in Los Altos Hills, retired Lockheed engineer, very, very knowledgeable about all engineering types. And he's the one that took the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 photos and found those spaceships in the Rings of Saturn. If we were ever to see an actual picture of what Saturn looks like, we would be speechless for a day because it's so beautiful, so big, so mammoth, so many things on Saturn that we would not have the words to describe it or even to think coherently for a full day if we ever saw it.
How does he get those pictures?
How did he get them?
Yes.
He was a Lockheed engineer, and he had access to NASA photos.
And they let him release it?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, anybody can get those same pictures that he has. You just have to find the right avenue and the right place. His weren't airbrushed. There's some devious ways you can get unairbrushed pictures, but it's very difficult these days because they control them very carefully. Now, all the pictures that you see these days from Clementine and the Mars stuff, that's all fake stuff. Any stuff that they don't want you to see is digitally removed, and you just see rocks and sand and stuff like that. The only way to get the real stuff is by early NASA stuff, the early Martian pictures. Of course, they were airbrushed, but not as carefully as they are these days. The moon pictures are all carefully airbrushed these days, much more carefully than they were pre-1970. And, of course, all the great moon photos that were taken by some of the great observatories like Mount Milsen and Mount Palomar are all impounded for the next 5 to 10 years. There's no way you can get at them. We've tried several times. They say, no, they're locked away and they aren't going to be released. They would have all of this stuff on them.
Why do you think Pluto was just defrocked a couple of years ago? Why are we being told it's now a non-planet?
I don't know. That's pretty interesting. I never did understand why that happened.
I thought that was fascinating. That would be an interesting piece maybe to bring you in on. I'm going to find out. I'd like to know.
Well, all planets, you know, have basically the same atmosphere as Earth. NASA would have you believe that the closer to the sun, the hotter the planet is, which is false because the sun, they would have you believe, is a nuclear action or a nuclear reaction or some kind of nuclear explosion. It's not. It's an electromagnetic sphere, and it emits an electromagnetic wave. And that wave, when it hits a planet, is controlled by that planet's atmosphere to control the temperature of any planet it approaches. So Venus, Mercury, which is the closest to the sun, has the same temperature as on Earth. Pluto, which is the farthest from the sun and supposed to be cold as an iceberg, has the same temperature as Earth. People live there, just like we live on Earth. But we're fed this stuff that the closer to the sun, the hotter we are, and that's not the truth.
It's literally like learning that almost everything you've been taught is a story.
Right.
It's kind of like losing your cosmic innocence for sure.
Yeah, it's like believing that Einstein was the greatest mathematician in the world. Einstein was nothing but a fraud. The only thing Nobel Prize he got was in 1921, and it was for something that his wife did. And his wife didn't want the prize, she wanted the money. So they made a pact that he would get the honor, but he would give her the money. Everything he said about special relativity, both general and special, is all BS. There's no truth to it. It's nothing. It's a fraud. And I've written on the livingmoon.com many, many articles of exactly why it's a fraud. It's all BS.
Do you think that we're going to be alive at a time when there will be more peace, people living together in communities, or somehow be able to return to a more agricultural life?
In many, many years, that will happen. But it won't be in our lifetime.
It's interesting you say that. I just asked Lynn Buchanan that. And what he shared, I'll tell you, was I said, what about 20 years from now? What about 2020?
No possibility.
That's what he saw in remote viewing. I didn't have a long talk with him about it, but I asked.
Well, I don't say it's impossible. I just say it's unlikely.
The secret space station with advanced technology, ATSS. Talk a little bit about that for us.
Well, there's 24 to 26 weaponized space stations, I should say orbiting platforms, and then there's two Navy command post orbiting platforms. When the shuttle launches, it should take about 9 minutes to get to the ISS, which is 220 miles out. But it normally takes about 3 days. And the excuse that NASA uses is that it's trying to catch up because it was launched at the wrong time and it takes forever to catch up with the ISS. That's not what they're doing. What they're doing is half the supplies in the shuttle are stopping at each one of these secret space stations and delivering food, vegetables, something that we need to live. Our secret space guys need to live, and they deliver people's food, supplies, machinery, and all that kinds of stuff. And then when it undocks from the space station, it should take them 54 minutes to deorbit and land at the Kennedy spaceport, but it takes 2.5 days. The reason it takes 2.5 days is 2 days before the shuttle arrives at the ISS, it just happens that two Russian rockets arrive at the ISS, and they're carrying more supplies, which is transferred to the shuttle. And then when it undocks, it goes back down through the line of satellites that it missed coming up and delivers food, supplies, vegetables, people, and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Now, we have other ways of getting to these space stations. 4 series of rockets like Delta, Sea Launch, I forget what the other ones are, they're man-rated. They have men, they have astronauts in them, and they can go up and dock, take supplies and stuff like that, and then they have other ways of coming back down.
Have you ever wanted to be on one?
No, I don't want to know any of that stuff. Once you get into a secret program, you're not allowed to talk about anything, so I'd rather not be in the secret program because I like to find out all the secrets and talk about them.
So 60 years, you think it'll be before disclosure is allowed, if at all?
That's right. 60 to 80 years is before they'll just start to leak a little bit about extraterrestrials.
You don't think a lot is already being leaked?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, you know, like up at Area 51, I mean, one set of aliens has their own administration building up there. And there's 5 underground levels. I think they work with at least 4 or 5 different sets of aliens up there. So they've got all kinds of cool stuff up there. Our technology is at least 100 years ahead of where the normal public thinks it is. They think our technology is the shuttle. That's as far as advanced as we got. And they talked about going to the moon, and then they couldn't find any of the plans of the Atlas rocket that took us to the moon. And the reason they couldn't find any plans is there weren't any. You know, we never did go to the moon. So the Atlas rocket did exist, but it didn't take us to the moon. There's also the story about the 700 missing tapes, masters of us on the moon. And those things are missing. They're missing because there was no videotapes of the moon, because it didn't happen.
Are you referring to the Stanley Kubrick? Because I don't think the public knows what you're referring to. Speak a little bit about that. Fill the public in. I feel like we need to fill that part in, because Stanley Kubrick...
It was all fake. They have to go to livingmoon.com. We have a bunch of figures, a bunch of photos of the facilities that they used to fake the moon landings. They have a huge construction tower that they used to simulate the takeoff and landing on the moon. They have a huge indoor facility where they brought in moon dust, or dust similar to the moon, and the astronauts prancing around. If they were really in 1/6 gravity, they would be able to jump a lot higher than the 18 inches they did. All that was fake. Now, the Stanley Kubrick photo of the light standard falling down on Neil Armstrong is great. And what I'm in the process of doing is trying to get a video match with a NASA-released video of him going down the steps as compared with the clip that's going around the internet now of the light standard falling on Neil Armstrong, and see how close they are. I think they'll be identical.
Wow.
A lot of people say, no, that was a fake made by Stanley, and it was an inside joke and all that. No, that really happened. They really had a little accident with a light standard when they were faking, this is one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind, and then the light standard falls down.
It sounds like life is an optical illusion, John.
It is. It's an illusion. Everything is an illusion.
These are in ancient teachings. I'm sure you know that, that so much of life is an illusion. But this is really like an optical illusion, too.
Yeah.
Why do you think our president has just endorsed our going to Mars and not the moon?
Well, first of all, we can't get to the moon because of this Van Allen belt. And so now they can delay it about 5 or 10 years while we dream up a way to go to Mars, which we can't get to. Now, I've heard that we do have people on the moon and Mars, but I'm not sure I believe it. I don't have any way of proving it this way or that way. But we're certainly going to do away with the moon idea, because I don't think we're wanted there or really have any business there. So now he can delay any action by NASA of saying we're going to Mars, which is infinitely more technical, and delay it and then pass it off to some other president. Say, no, we don't want to go to Mars. We want to go to Neptune or someplace like that.
Because there's been this recent development and preoccupation with Mars. I was like, what is the preoccupation? What is it? Why do we care?
Really? I don't know. That would be in the big plan. I don't know what the big plan is.
Do you think there's a federation of beings that are running things? Almost
it's
like
not a federation.
Okay.
It's not like the Galactic Federation, but there is a union between all the different aliens. Some of the flying saucers you see come down, they're just from other planets, and they're coming down as a sightseeing trip to Earth and see how early humans live and the battles they go through and stuff like that. It's just sightseeing.
Well, whatever they dreamed up something gorgeous. This Earth is gorgeous. The oceans, the trees, the mountains, the skies. I mean, doesn't that sound like a certain intelligence is behind that or something?
You mean our Earth?
Yeah.
There's a billion times a billion Earths similar, if not identical, to ours. Some of the people that live there are more advanced than us. Some are less advanced than us. But there's billions of them, a billion times a billion. And they all have the same rocks and mountains and forests and lakes. And
as pretty as ours?
Yes. Some even prettier.
How do you know that?
Well, that information comes from Lou Baldwin, who's Sleeper. And Sleeper's blog. He has two books out. One is called A Day with an Extraterrestrial. The other one he wrote is about what they did with the saucers that they recovered at Roswell. And it's a fascinating book. It's actually fiction based on the reality of what happened and what they found and what they did with all the little things that they found on the Roswell ship.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Bob Lazar?
Yeah, Bob was a good friend. We met in the summer of 88. When we met, he had worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories for some time. He was a scientist. He had a top secret clearance, and he and a friend, Gene Huff, and I would talk about flying saucers, and Bob Lazar would roll his eyes saying, "It's not true. I would have known about it. There's no possibility there's anything like flying saucers." And after about 4 months, we convinced him that there might be. So he got a job up at Area 51 because he knew Dr. Teller. First night he got back from Area 51, he came into my room and my den, and I'm writing checks and everything. He says, "I saw a disc today." And I said, "Theirs or ours?" He said, "Theirs." I said, "You went to Groom Lake?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, what are you coming here for? They obviously followed you. Why don't you find out what's going on and then come and tell me?" He said, "John, you've taken so much crap over this that I wanted to tell you it's true. I saw it. I touched it. I was in it. It's real." That was about it.
He didn't get in trouble for telling you that?
Yeah, eventually. Eventually, we went out on March 22nd, 1989 to see one of the test flights, and we watched the flying saucers flying around. That was on a Wednesday, and then because they would test every Wednesday. And then the next Wednesday was the 29th, and I was on a trip with the airline I flew for to Cleveland, and I didn't get to go, but that's the night that they got some video of the saucers flying. And then on April 6th, which was the following Wednesday night, is when me and Bob and Bob's wife and Bob's wife's sister went up, and Gene Huff, and we got caught by security. And before security actually got to our car, Bob jumped out and went into the desert. And then when security left, he came back in. And then when we drove off the Groom Lake Road, the Lincoln County police stopped us and questioned us, and then finally let us go. And then the next day, Bob was picked up by his boss, who was called Dennis Mariana, and taken to the Central Intelligence Headquarters for the Nevada test site. And they said to Bob, "Now, Bob, when we gave you this clearance, it didn't mean you were supposed to take all of your friends up to see the flying saucers."
Now, we're all kids at heart, you know.
You want to work with us or not? At the time, Bob was going through a divorce, and on the last two trips up to Groom Lake, he could remember getting on the airplane, and he could remember getting off the airplane here at Las Vegas, but he couldn't remember anything in between. So he didn't want to work on a program where they had a mind control program going on that you can't remember what you did during the day.
How do you even recall it at that point? How do you even get back to work to recall it if it's been stripped of you? I guess it's stripped in a time frame, right?
Right.
Yeah. Do you think we time travel?
Yeah, certainly it's possible. We can go forward in time and backward in time.
Do you think that's been going on a long time?
Forever.
I remember going to a conference years ago. It was the Cancer Control Conference. And a gentleman sitting in a booth used to be with one of the agencies. I don't remember which one now. I don't know how we got on the subject, and he said to me, "I just want to tell you that whatever is being eked out to the public, we're 100 years in front of whatever you're going to hear of, and thousands of years of advanced technology translated."
Right. Yeah.
He goes, "You have no idea what we're capable of and what's at our fingertips and what's accessible, and you'll never get it."
Right, right. He's right.
Fascinating. Well, I really want to thank you for joining us today. And there's so much to talk to you about, John. I don't want to overwhelm the public the first time talking with you. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with, learning from, and listening to John Lear. You can reach John at thelivingmoon.com. John, thank you again, and we hope that you'll come back and join us. It's been a pleasure, and I've learned a lot today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.